When police discovered a handwritten list of 61 initials tucked in a suitcase in the back of Randy Kraft's car, they were puzzled by what it meant. Later, it became clear. The list was a scorecard of men Randy Kraft had murdered. For more than a decade, Randy Kraft predated on dozens of young men around Southern California, intoxicating them first with his charm, then with alcohol and drugs, followed by some of the most sadistic acts of torture and murder ever to confront law enforcers. Born in March 1946, Randy Steve Kraft grew up in a homely environment with his parents and three older sisters in a conservative middle-class neighborhood in Orange County.
One of the most intriguing things I find about Randy Kraft is when he became the killer that he was. He had a really stable childhood. He had a doting mother. He had three elder sisters, and they all doted on him.
Kraft excelled at school. While attending Westminster High School, he graduated among the top 10 out of 390 students. Winning a scholarship to the prestigious Claremont Men's College, he then enrolled in the Reserve Officer Training Corps and marched in support of the Vietnam War. In his second year of university, he was embracing his sexuality, entering into his first homosexual relationship. In 1966, at a time when homosexuality in California was still illegal, Kraft was arrested for lewd conduct with another man in Huntington Beach. He graduated with a degree in economics, and a few months later was accepted into the U.S. Air Force. Stationed at Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California, he rose to the rank of Airman First Class. That same year, he came out to his family. His mother was apparently understanding, but his father took a lot longer to accept his son's sexuality. By July 1969, his blossoming Air Force career ended abruptly.
He had a good education, he was intelligent, he had everything going for him. And he tried various jobs, university, he went in the military, did all the American things. And it seems that his life really started to unravel when the military kicked him out because he came out as being gay. So in 1969, they kicked him out of the military because he was gay. And the next year, 1970, the sexual assaults started from him.
Randy Kraft's first known assault was on a 13-year-old runaway called Joey Fancher, who he met at Huntington Beach Boardwalk. Kraft enticed Fancher back to his apartment, where he plied him with alcohol and pills, before sodomizing him. When Kraft left his apartment to go to work, Fancher fled barefoot and ended up in a hospital where doctors pumped his stomach. Police paid a visit to Kraft's apartment and, as well as finding illegal drugs, found 76 photos of Kraft engaging in various sex acts with men. No charges were pressed because police had searched his apartment without a warrant. 2 years after he was discharged from the Air Force, Kraft enrolled at Long Beach State University, where he met and moved in with fellow student Jeff Graves. Although Kraft was now in a steady relationship, it did nothing to stem his desire to coax young men back to his place.
He would haunt the bars, the gay bars. He would pick up someone. Apparently, he was really charismatic. He was intelligent. He could hold conversations with people about any subject. He liked military people because he'd been in the military before. So he used to like young Marines, and he'd invite them back to his place afterwards, and they'd drink and they'd chat and they'd talk. And some of them have even mentioned that he was almost hypnotic without any suggestion at all that there was a sexual undertone into the pickup that he'd effectively just made. There was a lot of people who escaped Randy Kraft, so they've been able to talk about it since.
What propelled Kraft to unleash such torturous horrors upon so many young men remains a mystery. Edward Moore was a 20-year-old Marine. He was last seen alive leaving his barracks on Christmas Eve 1972. 2 days later, his body turned up on the 405 freeway. It had been thrown from a moving vehicle. An autopsy, however, revealed the scope of horrors inflicted on him. He'd been bound, beaten, bitten, and garroted. while a sock was found forced up his rectum. It would become a grotesque signature of Randy Kraft's crimes that would scar Southern California for more than a decade. Over the course of 1973, Kraft brutalized at least four young men. In February, a body, as yet unidentified, was found on Terminal Island Freeway. He had been strangled, and a sock forced up his rectum. 2 months later, Kraft murdered at least three men. Among them was 17-year-old Kevin Bailey, who was found dead in Huntington Beach. He, too, had been sodomized, but also emasculated.
He's the only person I've come across that would emasculate men. In other words, he would actually cut the testicles and the penis off and hold it up to the victim. But he'd do it to a live victim. I've had it done, tragically, to people that are already dead. And it took me back to medieval times. And you'd die of shock, because once you emasculate a man, the blood loss is horrendous.
By December, Kraft had resorted to dismembering more body parts of his victims. 23-year-old art student Vincent Cruz Mestas was found in the San Bernardino Mountains. As well as having a sock inserted into his rectum, his hands had been cut off.
This is a sadistic thing. He obviously gets off on the pain, the anguish, and the agony of his victims. The more agony his victim's in, the more he gets his sexual kicks from it.
At least three murders were attributed to Kraft in 1974. 20-year-old Malcolm Little, 19-year-old James Reeves, and 18-year-old Marine Roger Dickerson. He developed a type of victim, young, Caucasian, male. He had also developed a method to his murder.
Alcohol and drugs, same old story. They would have a drink together, he would then administer drugs somehow till they were really under his control, and then that was it. They were bound and they were over to him. He could tie them up, he could do what he wanted with them. But he would have had to have taken them to a remote area, because to do that to a live victim, the screams would have been just inhuman. So that's the really mystery side of Randy Kraft. Why was he so violent? He would enjoy the kill, he would prolong the kill, and he would make it last as long as he could. And the problem was, what he did to his victims would leave a mess as far as a crime scene goes.
Messy crime scenes would come back to haunt Randy Kraft years later. In the meantime, Kraft was insatiable. In January 1975, he abducted and murdered 17-year-old John Larris. The high school student was last seen alive boarding a bus in Long Beach. His dead body was found with a foreign object inserted in his anus. In the same month, police investigators convened to try and crack the case that had become known as the Southern California Strangler. They even came close to making an arrest. In May 1975, Kraft was questioned by police about the murder of Keith Crotwell. Friends of Crotwell had seen him slumped in a car belonging to Kraft, but a coroner's verdict found Crotwell had died from accidental drowning, curtailing any plans the police had to arrest Kraft. Instead, the bodies of murdered young white men continued to be found in and around Long Beach. Kraft wasn't the first or only serial killer to target men, but the extremity of his calculated sadism was shocking, even to veteran forensic investigator Robin Knapper.
The anger that he took out on his victims is frankly a level above anything I've ever seen.
In the summer of 1975, Kraft split up with his live-in partner. He waited until New Year's Eve to murder again, unleashing his most vicious acts to date on 22-year-old Mark Hall. Kraft bound Hall to a tree in a remote canyon. Hall had also been sodomized, emasculated, and his rectum inserted with a foreign object. This time, however, the foreign object was Hall's own genitals. The autopsy reported that Hall had died from asphyxiation, not from being strangled, but suffocating on leaves and earth that had been rammed down his throat. Burns from a car cigarette lighter were found all over his body, including his scrotum and eyes.
The one thing that's really staggered me about Randy Kraft is the violence that he used to use on his victims. It is some of the most extreme violence I've ever seen anywhere. He used to like to stuff items of clothing up the anal passages of his victims or jam something down their throat. So once you get these telltale signs on a body, and it happens consistently within a geographic area, you've got your first indications that you've got the same person operating. He gets his kicks a certain way, and it's like us when we go to the bar for a drink. We like a certain type of drink, we like a certain type of food, and we'll regularly go and do that to get the most pleasure.
In 1978, Kraft butchered and killed six more young men, including Marines Scott Hughes and Richard Keith. Most of the victims' bodies were found on the side of the freeway, pushed from a moving vehicle. This grim pattern continued well into the following year, when he murdered five men in 7 months. His obscene bloodlust had escalated to severing the limbs and heads of three of his victims, though only two could be identified as 20-year-old Gregory Wallace Jolly and 19-year-old Mark Allen Marsh, yet another Marine. The 1980s saw no let-up. Kraft's disturbingly distinct trail of murdered men now stretched to Oregon and Colorado, with the discovery of dead bodies coinciding with his business trips to those states. At last, in 1983, Kraft's horrific acts came to an end. One May night, Kraft was pulled over by two California highway policemen, Officer Sterling and Officer Howard, for driving erratically. Failing the breathalyzer test, Officer Sterling arrested Kraft for driving under the influence. Officer Howard proceeded to look on Kraft's passenger, who was slumped under a jacket in the front seat.
He was arrested for something quite mundane, drink driving. The California Highway Patrol saw him driving erratically in 1983, pulled him over, and there's Randy Kraft driving the car. They took him out of the car, went to speak to his passenger, who wasn't very responsive, for a very good reason, because the passenger was dead. It was his latest victim that he'd actually killed. So the police realized, oh, holy moly, what have we got here?
The police officers had discovered the body of 25-year-old Marine Terry Gambrell. Although his body contained high levels of alcohol and a prescription tranquilizer, Gambrell had been in fact strangled to death with a belt. Kraft was taken into custody. When police searched his car, they discovered a handwritten list with more than 60 coded initials inscribed on it. To their horror, they soon worked out they were looking at a scorecard of Kraft's deadly encounters.
So, Randy was taken in custody, the car was taken in custody, and when they searched the car, they found this infamous scorecard. There was a list there with 61 initials on there, which had been written by Randy Kraft, that we now know indicates a lot of the victims that he actually killed. They think that that scorecard, which is where he got the name the Scorecard Killer came from, indicates probably up to 67 victims that he may have killed, but they've only been able to put names to about half of those. They've been able to take some of the bodies that they found. Certainly there were two initials at one stage, and they related to a double murder he did one night. So they were able to match that one up, and obviously they were able to match the times and the dates up as well. But he was killing between 1970 and 1983, so this list spanned a 13-year period. And they're only the ones he killed. There could have been others that possibly escaped, who possibly could have fought back, but he almost had a lucky run not to have been captured for 13 years.
Evidence retrieved from Kraft's car and later from his home incriminated him in unresolved murders. The trove included Polaroids of murdered young men, belts, shoelaces, and human bloodstains. Kraft's trial began in September 1988, more than 5 years after his arrest. After listening to testimony for 13 months, the jury found Randy Stephen Kraft guilty of 16 counts of murder, one count of sodomy, and one count of emasculation. He was sentenced to death. It was a throwaway remark from an eager policeman, and it stuck like glue. During the search for a killer who had taken six lives in two separate incidents in February 1991, Lieutenant Ray Biondi was addressing local media in Sacramento. In both incidents, there was evidence of low-level robbery, but the callous disregard for life did not appear to fit the extent of such minor crimes. Biondi was asked what could possibly motivate such an extreme and murderous outcome, and his answer would immediately give media a label to attach to the man being hunted by police.
That was my mistake in an interview. They were asking, well, why did he kill these people? And I said, well, probably for the thrill of it. I couldn't figure out any other reason. Boom, that was the headline.
Police were on the hunt for the Sacramento thrill killer. Eric Royce Leonard was just 8 months old when he had a seizure brought on by a high temperature. By the time he was four, he'd been diagnosed with epilepsy and was prescribed medication to control his seizures. He lived variously with his parents, who had split soon after his birth, for a while staying with his mother in Missouri, but mainly making his home in California. He graduated from high school in 1988, and although he enrolled in junior college in 1990, a life of crime came suddenly. In January 1991, he was arrested for stealing bathroom scales, and on February 11th, he pled guilty to the crime. The following day, Eric Royce Leonard pulled on a black trench coat, took his father's .25 caliber Beretta pistol, and headed to the local Quick Stop convenience store. With no apparent motive, he walked into the store and shot dead from close range store assistants Zaid Obeid and Steven Anderson and customer Thor Johnson.
What was weird about that was there wasn't a lot taken from the store except beef jerky, the kind of pick up off the counter, because we found a lot of the containers for it outside the back door where it had been abandoned. So we're working this, and unfortunately this Quick Stop market is right there near close to an off-ramp on Interstate 80. So we're thinking, a couple robber came through town and boogied on up or went north or south on 80, you know. It looked like just a robbery in a store, and somebody wasted everybody that was in there. The following Tuesday, less than a half a mile away in a Round Table Pizza in the evening in a very busy shopping center, somebody went in there and shot all three employees, again with .25 caliber. And they were all, if I remember, headshots. So, yeah, things are hooked together now. We had like two theories going at the time. One is maybe we got some really bad guys who came into town on 80, because both places were right next to the off ramps, stuck around for a week and committed these. Or it's somebody who's right in the area, lives in the area, familiar with the area. And that was kind of where I was leaning. So after the second Tuesday, the sheriff's bar really mobilized. I mean, we had people all over, we're ready for the third Tuesday. And unfortunately, there was a young man who stole a car and drove into that area. He probably never saw as many guns as he, at that particular point. Here are all these sheriff's deputies dressed as gas station attendants, store clerks, and there's helicopters overhead, highway patrol.
But it wasn't the man police were searching for. After the convenience store murders of Zaid Obeid and Steven Anderson, and customer Thor Johnson, Leonard had caused citywide panic by waiting just 7 days before shooting and killing three staff members at the Round Table Pizza store: Sarah Crook, Kyle Reynolds, and Andrea Colodangelo had all been shot in the head multiple times from close range. Concerns that the thrill killer could strike again as coldly and brutally as he had on two consecutive Tuesdays led California police into a frenzy of activity.
We kept a real intensive canvas going. Behind the apartments where the market was a lot of apartments. And we were just knocking on doors as often as we could. We also had some sightings in some other stores further away, because kind of a suspicious looking character. Some of the sightings talked about kind of a young man in this trench coat, a full trench coat, heavy kind of trench coat, which was kind of peculiar in Sacramento. I mean, if you live in New York, you wear a trench coat, but you don't wear one here.
Just 2 days after the Round Table Pizza store killings, Eric Leonard, who had been seen near the Quick Stop on the night of the first three murders, was interviewed by Sheriff's Deputy Robert Bell. According to the court records, the sheriff's deputy considered Leonard to be timid, frightened, confused, and appeared to be mentally disabled. As a result, he was ruled out as a possible suspect. On the third Tuesday, with Sacramento on high alert, there was relief when there was no further related tragedy, and the manhunt continued. For 17 years, Lieutenant Biondi had chased criminals, primarily to bring them to justice. But there was also a personal and more emotional purpose to his work. On his retirement, the unsolved murders still lingered in his mind, as did many of the dreaded police death knocks when he and his colleagues delivered the tragic news of murdered loved ones to partners, brothers, sisters, sons, and daughters.
That was difficult, doing the death notification. I'm sorry your son didn't come home last night. He has been murdered. Not he's deceased or passed away. He has been murdered and we found his body, blah, blah, blah. Those are hard. I learned quickly, you got to get somebody in there with you. In one particular case, I went in and the family went berserk. I mean, everything but nearly breaking the windows out. Standing in there and all these people are going just bananas. I don't know if I was going to control them or not. But yeah, you need to think about how you're going to do it. And if they have other people, never do it alone. Never do it by yourself with only one relative or parent or whatever it is.
The desire to avoid another of these emotional conversations continued to drive Lieutenant Biondi in his pursuit of the man he had inadvertently dubbed the Thrill Killer. But it would take months for the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department to catch up with Eric Leonard.
We were pretty successful because we had a very small unit. At sometimes, I only had two detectives and myself. That was our unit. It got up to six and eight sometimes. So we tried hard to, when we had a murder, go down, we would try to solve it that night. If somebody was even slightly a person of interest or whatever, they're downtown. We're talking to them right then. We didn't do surveillance and hang around and background checks forever and all that because didn't have the manpower, really. You just had to go hit it really hard. Call it Goya code. Get off your ass and knock on doors.
No matter how gruesome the case or how hard he was required to work, Lieutenant Biondi stayed on the case.
I can remember the chaplains come around and say, Ray, how you doing? I said, hey, I'm fine. How are you? a cup of coffee. There were a couple that were really sad. And when you walk in the scene and you're trying not to step in 2 inches of blood, see something horrific. But after a while, it's isolation of effect. That's a body. That's a great big piece of evidence you need to really concern yourself with.
Knowledge of the weapon, the same 25 caliber Beretta that was used in both incidents, the description of a man in a black trench coat, and even the packets of beef jerky snacks left at the scene were critical in Leonard's eventual arrest. 3 months after the murders, and still searching for a solid lead, local store assistant Charlotte Henstra and office worker Shane Whitcomb added to the trench coat theory when they both told police they'd seen a man wearing the same coat on the night of the Quick Stop murders. On June 4th, Detective Stanley Reed learned of Deputy Robert Bell's previous interview with Eric Leonard and made a connection. When Bell told Reed he had taken a photo of Leonard, the picture was shown to Henstra and Whitcomb, who identified the subject. A local gun shop owner also told police he'd seen the man in the picture in his store before the shootings, and Sally Thomas, the fiance of murdered Stephen Anderson, provided a further positive identification of Leonard at the Quick Stop convenience store on the night of the first murders.
We started focusing on Eric Leonard. We went to his apartment and we picked him up. In fact, I picked him up. We took him downtown and we started talking to him, and he had some kind of convoluted story about, oh yeah, I had some ammunition. I bought it for some other guys. And whatever he was saying never made any sense. He was going to junior college, at least he told his dad he was. He wasn't actually attending class. We found in his apartment where he had been making jerky, but he didn't really give us anything, and he didn't know anything about any murders and stuff. So I found out his family was divorced. His dad lived out in the area out here. And so I go out and talk to his dad. I asked him, you know, you got any guns and all that? He said, yeah. I said, well, would you check and see if it's there? And so he did. He had a Corvette. And in the Corvette, he had this 25. I said, you know, mine, we want to match that up. We'll go examine it. So we took it to the, had somebody take it to the crime lab, and we're all sitting there waiting, and the detective comes back and he says, shit, you know, he says, it matched. So we had him. But what was strange about that is I was interviewed prior to that, and they asked me about who I thought it was. I mean, who were you looking for? I said, you know, we're probably looking for somebody. When all the people on the freeway kind of leads went away, I said, we're just looking for somebody right in the area and knows what's going on. Probably borrowed a gun from his uncle or his dad and put it back. And he did exactly that. He had put it back so dead, even though it was been used.
Eric Royce Leonard was 22 years old when he was arrested and interrogated by police, but refused to admit his guilt. The black trench coat, so crucial in identifying the perpetrator, showed no signs of blood, which seemed inconsistent with point-blank range shootings. Police explained the absence as simply the result of Leonard having washed the coat sometime during the 4 months between the killings and his capture. During the pretrial hearing, Leonard stunned the courtroom when he uttered, "I am guilty," before attempting to retract the statement. The outburst resulted in a psychiatric assessment, and he was declared competent and ordered to stand trial. In court, the defense argued Leonard had been incapable of committing the murders because of his mental and physical disabilities caused by epilepsy. The prosecution contended he'd been solely responsible for the murders of Zaid Obeid, Stephen Anderson, Thor Johnson, Sarah Crook, Kyle Reynolds, and Andrea Colodangelo. After years of legal argument in May 2007, Eric Royce Leonard was convicted of all 7 murders and sentenced to death.
Why he killed them all, he kind of felt like when he had that trench coat on and that gun in his pocket, he was really in control, because he was kind of a slight kid, really, that he was somebody, I think, was some explanation to what he did. He was all powerful. He went in there and killed everybody.
In November 2002, Leonard was transferred from death row to the Vacaville Medical Facility and placed under psychiatric medication after claiming Jesus had told him to put his hand in boiling water. In 2018, he was yet to face the executioner. Now retired from police work, former Lieutenant Ray Biondi lives with the memories of catching killers, including Eric Royce Leonard.
I think if I had any regrets, it was bittersweet, because I dedicated too much time to that job. Wasn't smart enough to go fishing with my sons more often. I know, my family paid for it, I think. But I always thought I had the most important job in all law enforcement. You know, I got to solve these murders.
During the summer of 1980, the deadly combination of Douglas Clark and Carol Bundy brought murder, mutilation, and necrophilia unleashed on the streets of Los Angeles, turning the city of angels into the place of nightmares.
That's how this bomb is put together. It's always the same with couples that kill. You've got the grenade and then you've got the fuse and they're inert. But when you put one into the other, you can have an explosion.
You have a classic case here of two damaged individuals who come together and create absolute mayhem.
Doug Clark was a sexual sadist with an antisocial personality disorder. At his trial, a psychiatrist described his psychopathic personality as being characterized by extreme narcissism and self-destructive behavior.
It's the only killer that I've ever interviewed who was shackled. And the reason he was shackled, because he was so angry with everything, the guards, everything, the way he'd been treated. It took me about, we had an hour, it took me about 35 minutes before I could calm him down. He was that furious and wild. He looks good like that on TV. His teeth are rotten. His eyes are blue and staring. His hair was matted. He looked like a monster.
In his prime, Douglas Clark was considered a handsome, charming man. Born in Pennsylvania in March 1948, he was the third of five children born to Blanche and Franklin Clark. The family frequently relocated across the U.S. and overseas as a result of his father's job as a career Navy officer. When Franklin retired from the Navy, he took on a senior role with the Transport Company of Texas, generating more international postings. The overseas assignments afforded the Clarks a privileged expat lifestyle. Douglas, with his older brother Walter, were sent to Switzerland's exclusive Ecola International School. All the while, Clark was developing unusual sexual fetishes that persisted as he grew older. When he was 9, he was caught wearing his mother's and sister's underwear.
Doug Clark, who again is a strange individual. When he was at school, he showed a very unhealthy interest in all sorts of deviant sex as a schoolboy, which is most unusual. He was trying to get threesomes at school and this sort of thing while most people are still studying for exams.
Douglas, although intelligent, was lazy and disruptive. After a series of misdemeanors, including drunkenness and writing an erotic letter to a teacher, he was expelled. At age 16, his parents dispatched him to Culver Military Academy in Indiana, where he soon alienated most of his classmates with his boasts about his wealth and sexual exploits. His conduct led him to a series of meetings with the school therapist, who wrote to Clark's parents informing them of their son's bad behavior. Clark graduated from Culver Military Academy in 1967, and he enlisted in the Air Force. He was posted to Anchorage, Alaska, tasked with decoding Russian messages. Although he loathed the military discipline, he enjoyed the nightlife and the dancer bars. But before his first term was up, Clark was mysteriously, although honorably, discharged. He left with his benefits intact and a National Defense Service Medal. The king of the one-night stand, as he liked to call himself, headed south to California.
He liked kinky sex. He didn't like to work too hard. He would use his charms. He was quite a good-looking guy. He'd use his charms to wheedle in with someone and to live off of people. And then once he'd sort of bled them dry of everything, he'd just move off somewhere else.
In 1972, he married his first wife, Sue, and together they established an upholstery business. It failed. Clark retrained as a steam engineer and took up work with the Department of Water and Power in Los Angeles. During their marriage, Doug sought out prostitutes. By 1976, he and Sue had divorced. 4 years later, in April 1980, he went to one of his regular drinking holes where he met an unassuming vocational nurse called Carol Bundy.
She had a horrendous childhood, both parents alcoholic, so they weren't interested in the kids at all. And when her mother died, when she was a teenager, the father just said, well, you've now got to take mum's place. And she was pulled straight into bed to sleep with dad and become a pseudo wife, if you like. So she escaped as soon as she could. And she actually tried to better herself. She became a nurse, but she had physical problems with her eyes. She had really, really bad eyesight. And after a while, her eyes started to deteriorate. And very sadly for her, it stopped her nursing. So she got a little bit lost in life. She tried to build up a relationship. She had one or two serious relationships, but nothing really worked for her. She was a bit lost. And in the midst of all this being lost and loneliness and looking for happiness, she unfortunately bumps into Doug Clark.
The 37-year-old twice divorced mother of two had gone to the little Nashville bar to watch her lover John Murray perform. She ended up being bedazzled by Douglas Clark. Within days, he had moved in with her.
Carol Bundy was short, fat, even shorter sighted. I mean, her glasses were bottle thick glasses and lenses. Ugly, craved sex, a dumpling of a woman who had a vicious streak in her. He saw her as a meal ticket. He saw as I can get some money out of you. And that's how that relationship started to develop. And then, you know, he drank a lot, but he was an extremely handsome man in his day.
Carol was so needy that she wanted to keep Doug happy. So all of a sudden, Doug realized he could ask Carol to do virtually anything, and she would do anything to keep him happy. And he managed to, for example, he managed to get her to purchase two handguns, two .25 handguns in her name, so he could have one, she could have one. But if they ever get caught, the handguns would come back as being registered to her.
Clark made himself comfortable moving in with Bundy. He carried one of her guns, drove her car, and solicited prostitutes for threesomes. On one occasion, Clark even brought home an 11-year-old. But instead of alarming Bundy, she participated in the pedophilic activities by taking photographs of Clark molesting the child. The couple were intent on gratifying their most vicious fantasies.
Once she saw that he was happy, then she was happy for him, if you like. So when they were doing the threesome, it kept Doug happy, she was happy. And of course, it ultimately led to Doug saying to her, a woman that really loves me will kill for me. So that's when they went out, picked a prostitute up, and committed their first murder together. And the tragedy is that Carol actually admitted in the police interview that she actually enjoyed the experience because it made Doug happy. She enjoyed the murder, and it was something she never thought she would.
Over the course of 15 weeks, six people would be shot dead by Clark and Bundy, and two of them would be decapitated. 17-year-old runaway Marnette Comer was last seen alive on June 1, 1980, wearing a pink T-shirt inscribed with Daddy's Girl across it. Clark had picked her up on Sunset Boulevard in Bundy's new car. He shot her four times as she struggled to escape, then gutted her with a knife. Her mummified body was found 3 weeks later in San Fernando Valley. On June 12, 1980, a highway worker found the bodies of 16-year-old Cynthia Chandler and her 15-year-old half-sister Gina Morano. Their dead bodies had been dumped beside a freeway ramp. Clark had shot dead both girls, then raped their dead bodies. When Clark divulged his deeds to Bundy, she rang the police, but didn't give away his identity. 12 days later, Exie Wilson and her colleague Karen Jones were looking for clients along Studio City's Ventura Boulevard. Clark picked up Wilson and drove to a quiet spot a few blocks away. As Wilson orally copulated Clark, he shot her in the head with the .25 caliber revolver. Clark then cut off her head with a buck knife, leaving her body on the side street. Karen Jones was the last person to see Exie Wilson alive. So Clark returned to Ventura Boulevard and shot her dead that same night. Clark later told Bundy he'd killed two more women. This time, Bundy showed no compunction to call police. Instead, she helped Clark realize his necrophilic obsession.
There were several murders, but there was the real grotesque sexual twist to it. The next two murders they did, they killed two prostitutes in one night, but one of them they actually decapitated. They took the head off. Clark cut the head off the prostitute, took it home and put it in the fridge, as you do, you know, kept it there. And Carol saw the head in the fridge the next morning, but what she didn't realize was that Clark wanted to use the head for his necrophiliac purposes. And she takes the head out of the fridge and she puts makeup on it for him and gives it to him so he can go off in the bedroom and do his grotesque sexual things that he did with the head. And when the head is eventually discarded in a box where it's found by someone, when the medical examiner examines it, he actually finds traces of semen around the lips of the mouth. So it's a horrendous necrophiliac sexual kick, and Carol was helping Doug do it.
The couple wrapped up Wilson's head in a pink Daddy's Girl T-shirt, just like the one worn by Marnette Comer. They put the head in a wooden box and dumped it in an alleyway close to where Clark had left Wilson's body. The discovery led to a police press conference seeking help from the public. The slayings, alarming the local community, were now being described by the media as the work of the Sunset Strip killer. In late August 1980, the body of an unidentified woman was discovered by a water tower. She'd been shot in the head. Bundy alleges Clark shot her dead as she performed oral copulation on him and then sexually assaulted her dead body. Clark alleges that Bundy shot the girl in the head as she performed a sex act on him. The secrets were becoming too much for Carol Bundy, who vented to her ex-lover, John Murray.
Now, it's quite interesting because Clark actually liked having Carol around because he could manipulate her, he could live off of her, the guns were registered in her name. But there was a problem. Carol suddenly realized that Doug's really not the full ticket and she might be the next victim. So she wasn't quite sure whether keeping him happy was going to keep her alive. And she actually discloses to an ex-boyfriend, a guy called John Murray, that she's a bit worried because her and Doug have gone and killed people. Well, Murray initially didn't believe her. He thought she was just talking rubbish, you know, she had too much to drink. But she said, look, I'll explain to you tonight, and on the promise of a sexual favor, John Murray took her to his motorhome one night, and what happened was they didn't have sex. Carol actually shot him. She shot him in the head with her 25, and she then proceeded to decapitate him in the caravan. And she took the head home to Doug Clark, and she opened the conversation up saying, I've been to see John tonight and told him what we've done. And because Clark exploded in anger, then she said, here, have a look. And then she takes the head out and presents the head to him, thinking she's keeping him happy. That's how twisted and morphed her mind had become. She also said in an interview that she wanted the head because having shot him in the head, she knew that ballistics and forensics could actually link it to the gun. So she wanted to take the forensics with her. And the only way she knew she could do that was to cut the head off. So Clark had effectively warped this woman's thinking beyond belief.
8 days later, the stench emanating from John Murray's decomposing body drew attention, and Carol Bundy had reached the breaking point.
Somebody reported the motorhome smelling really high. Obviously, there was a decomposing body in there. Then they find the head missing from the body. The last person known to have been with him was Carol Bundy. So she's picked up, and eventually she confesses everything, and she's told how it happened, how she met him, and that's when Clark got himself arrested. Carol then tells them about the other prostitute murders, but of course when Clark is then picked up and interviewed, he just said, hey, I know all this from Carol. He said she's killed all these other women, and he immediately went into self-preservation mode.
Criminologist Christopher Barry Dee thinks Clark was justified to go on the defense.
Dougie Clark's a very intelligent man. Don't get me wrong, he's not a fool. He's not a rate, you know, you might be a bit of an idiot for getting involved with Bundy. He was certainly fitted up by police over bloodstains, which were allegedly bloodstains in a garage where he chopped Exie Wilson's head off. But there was no blood there. It was all what the police fitted up and fitted the case up to convict him.
The evidence continued to stack up against Clark.
He knew that the guns that had been used to kill were registered to her. Police hadn't actually found those guns at that time. And it wasn't until they did a really thorough search of Clark's place of work, they found both of the guns hidden. So they were able to get the guns out, match all the cartridges and the bullets, and to prove that they were the guns that actually caused the murders.
Clark admitted to using prostitutes, but he denied any involvement in the murders, claiming Bundy and her ex-lover John Murray were the culprits.
He completely sold her down the river. She was the mad one, she was the killer, she was this, she was that.
Barry Dee has reached a different conclusion about Clark's involvement.
Yes, he was with Carol Bundy when she shot one woman. I know that he disposed of the head of a man in a bin, but he didn't pull the trigger, and I don't believe he was complicit in the murders. It was Carol Bundy. She was the mover, but he was the idiot that went along with her. Douglas Clark is an intelligent man, but let's just say he's not streetwise. I mean, when he knew that, when Carol Bundy took Dougie out for a birthday present to find a hooker so Doug could have sex with the hooker in the back of the car, And Dougie's having his birthday present. And Carol just leans over with a pistol and shoots the girl in the head. Now, Dougie hadn't, you know, you couldn't understand what happened. It wasn't a plan, he didn't plan to kill her. He could have really gone to the police straight away and said, hey, I was in the car. But then she's saying to him, well, I'll say you shot her. And that's how the control comes into it. Everything he was telling me about Christopher, you've got to understand, this had happened, but nobody's ever taken notice of me. Carol Bundy was lying, they fitted me up.
In October 1982, Douglas Clark stood trial for 6 counts of first-degree murder, attempted murder, mutilation of human remains, and use of a dangerous weapon. During the trial, he represented himself, accusing his lawyer of being a buffoon attorney and half inebriated. He railed against the court procedures and the authority of the judge, and was repeatedly warned about his behavior, even being removed from court after hurling too many profanities.
Many serial killers I interview are very calm and calculated. They're very controlled. Douglas Clark is the only one that's loosed off at me. Furious at the whole system. It's almost he's screaming, I'm innocent. Don't you people listen to me. Please listen to what I'm trying to tell you. But he can't describe it in an eloquent way. He's letting his emotions come out.
I suppose the only good thing you could say about the court process was they didn't buy it. They realised that probably she was the one that had been manipulated and abused, even though she had culpability for the murders that she did actually commit. So ultimately, they both got convicted of murder.
In January 1983, the jury found Douglas Daniel Clark guilty of all charges and was sentenced to death. Carol Bundy plea bargained. She was found guilty of 2 murders and sentenced to 52 years in jail. She died in 2003 of heart disease, having served 30 years of her term. She was age 60. Douglas Clark remains on death row at San Quentin Prison. In spite of numerous appeals, he continues to await his fate.